Tested is sponsored by Hungry Harvest, delivering farm-fresh produce and kitchen staples to your door starting at $15. Every delivery fights food waste and supports local hunger-solving organizations. HungryHarvest.net.
I'm Leonida Inge. This is Test It from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, the anti-bias classroom. Okay, class, settle down now. No snacking on Zoom. Clyde, please mute yourself while I'm talking. Cassie, turn your camera on so we can get started. Now, raise your hand if you've ever heard of the doll tests. Anybody? Okay, then. Let's get into it. The infamous doll tests were conducted in the 1940s by two pioneering African-American psychologists, Kenneth and Mamie Clark. They wanted to prove the negative psychological effects of segregation on Black children. Researchers would show the children a Black doll and a white doll, and in so many words, ask which one was better. The study has been recreated many times over the years, with similar results.
Which doll is the pretty doll? Which doll is the nice doll? Which doll is the bad doll?
The Clark's findings in the 1940s had a huge effect. In 1954, the NAACP used the research as part of their case in Brown v. Board of Education, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled racial segregation of children in public schools was unconstitutional. But integrated schools have not done away with our implicit biases.
And why is that doll pretty?
Because she's white and
he
has two eyes.
Which doll is the ugly doll? Why is that doll ugly?
Because he's black.
The results of the doll test is evidence that even the youngest of children carry implicit bias. Attitudes are stereotypes we're socialized to believe. And if it exists in our littlest ones, you know it's in adults too. Our biases show up everywhere, in the workplace, in the doctor's office, and in the classroom.
Now we're going to look at our letters.
I can tell you firsthand that being a Black parent means you have to be involved in your child's education, not just helping out with homework, but letting teachers and administrators know your kid has a vocal advocate for their fair treatment. And that hasn't changed now that most learning in our state is happening on Zoom. Our executive producer, Lindsay Foster Thomas, is a Black mom to a Black 4-year-old in Durham. She's told us discrimination is still a concern, even in the virtual version of pre-K. Kids are taught to raise their hands if they want to be called on. But some days, her daughter's hand gets overlooked again and again by the white lead teacher. And she has to ask why.
Okay, she's been raising her hand.
Yeah, I was just trying to give everyone a turn, and she was raising it when I was talking, so I was like trying to get through.
We're talking about the potential to do real harm, not because we have the bias, but because we have the bias and we don't know it.
A few years ago, Yale researcher Walter Gilliam conducted a study on implicit bias among preschool teachers. His team asked educators to watch videos of four children in a classroom setting. One Black boy, one white boy, one Black girl, one white girl. Here he is talking with Kentucky Educational Television in 2017.
And we say, now you're gonna watch some videos, and some of the times, children engage in challenging behaviors, but sometimes we can see those behaviors before they become too problematic. Your job is to watch these children and hit this button anytime you see something that could turn into a challenging behavior.
Meanwhile, Gilliam's team used a tool to see who the participants were keeping an eye on the most.
So basically, we were priming. We were cueing these teachers to expect that a child is going to misbehave, and your job is to find that child who's going to misbehave.
So, want to take a guess at who they said was misbehaving the most? The two black students, particularly the black boy. But here's the kicker.
But what we didn't tell the teachers is this. No child misbehaves in any of the videos because all the children are child actors that we have hired who are sitting around a table in an empty classroom. What we were really looking at was not how quickly can you find challenging behaviors. What we were really looking for was this. When we lead you to believe that a child's going to misbehave, who do you decide to look at? You're a preschool teacher, and I've led you to believe that a child's going to misbehave. Who do you think it's going to be?
Bias is almost a form of racism, but just in sort of in this smaller version of a classroom or a program.
That's Ioma Iruka. She's a professor in public policy and the director of the Early Childhood Health and Racial Equity Program at UNC Chapel Hill. She says bias in the classroom can cause some serious consequences for kids' well-being, especially when young students are disciplined. Data from the Department of Education shows that black public preschoolers are 3.6 times more likely to be suspended compared to their white classmates. Preschoolers being suspended. Iruka says a way to mend these disciplinary disparities is creating an anti-bias classroom.
An anti-bias classroom, you know, is one where, you know, children are not viewed by their sort of identities only, right? Like, you know, you're a black boy, so that means that I have these inherent sort of expectations of you, usually negative. And so I'm going to create an environment that's low expectations. Or you're Latino, so you must not know any English. And so I should not speak to you in English or, you know, so there's certain identities that in some ways, it's just the way our brain functions, right? Bias is really a brain functioning sort of thing where it's unconditional and we do it whether we want to or not. And so it actually means that you have to be intentional about seeing each individual child in a very clear way about who are you, what are your skill sets, and how could I help you reach your best self, right? Not the one I think you are. So that means that we have to have expectations that says, here's what I expect of you, not because of what society says you are, but because of what you are and what I expect of you. So I would say an anti-bias classroom is where it's about sort of saying, you know what, no matter what society says about you, in this classroom, I expect the best of you, and I will provide the opportunity for you to show your best.
So how do we do this, you know, have an anti-bias virtual classroom? We're in the middle of a pandemic, you know, so everybody's having to do things differently. You know, how does a teacher, you know, get through to their students that way in the setting that we live in today?
Yeah. I mean, because clearly I have a 3 and 7 year old. So trust me, when I work full time still, and I have like 50 jobs. So I really completely respect and value our teachers, our educators who are doing so much. I would say that part, like to me, in many ways, we're actually seeing, you know, some of the continuation of what was happening in person, virtual. We're seeing sort of this hyper vigilance with certain groups of children. We've heard of stories of people calling the cops because of a BB gun or something that they saw or thought or heard. We're seeing children being publicly sort of disciplined, like, hey, Jamie, sit down, right? Like, we're still seeing some of those acts of microaggressions and biases still coming up because not like the children teachers change so much. Is that the media from which they function in has changed. And so if a teacher is highly stressed, then that's the thing we know about science. When somebody's highly stressed, they're likely to go with their bias and not so much about what they should do. And so a lot of that is already coming forth. So what I would say we have to probably do is to remind ourselves is that we probably need to support teachers even much more than before. And also don't forget that children are dealing with their own stressors, right? Like how many kids were working virtually online, having to sit still in front of a camera, right? That in itself could be toxic, right? Could be stressful. And so I think we have to in some ways begin to sort of acknowledge that we've never been in this situation. And so everybody is dealing with a level of stress. So I think adults have to be adults. and not try to sort of put their adult challenges on children who are still children, who still are going through a level of brain development, self-regulation. And so many ways to me, to do anti-bias virtual classroom is to ensure that teachers are at least aware of their stress level. They're also aware of whether they're being much more hyper-vigilant with certain groups of children. They have to also understand, what are your children experiencing? Have you had separate conversations with each of your children and their families, right? Have you had that family conference? So how do we continue to create that learning environment in a way that takes into account all the differences that children are experiencing and families are experiencing? And that can only be done by conversations and communication and relationship building.
I like the way you use the term opportunity gap instead of achievement gap, because achievement gap means what? It's the children's fault, you know, that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. But when we think about even the opportunity gap, do you think the situation is worsening during this pandemic and virtual teaching? Or, you know, maybe the gap is decreasing because maybe a lot of parents now have to really pay very close attention to the work their children are doing.
I think there's not even it's not like one or the other. I think so. Let me start with the sort of like, I remember when it started and I started hearing all the people were like, oh my God, the achievement gap is going to get worse. Oh my goodness. Panic, panic, panic. And I was thinking in my head, like, well, that could be true. But if we actually look at it from another side of it, is that children probably won't be suspended. Because if you were suspended, you're not learning anyways. Children won't be, you know, abused in terms of emotion. They won't face microaggressions. And I'm thinking about Black children in particular. So, and that while they're home, there's probably more connection. We heard that more fathers were spending more time with their children. So there's relationships they're able to develop that wasn't there before. Like, I think about myself, I was traveling a lot. But I was able to now really have a much deeper relationship with my child and my children. So I think there's some benefits that we should take account of, because we know that relationships between parents and children actually matter, and matters even much more so than schools. But of course, there's the other side where we know that there are children who are struggling, who are not getting the most enriching experiences, who are struggling with relationships because their families are highly stressed out of the home, can't work from home. So we do have those side of the coins. But I think what COVID-19 has shown us, and I tell this to people all the time, COVID-19 just is another set of glasses that we should wear forever to show us that racism and racial disparities have always been here. They were always in front of us, and it allows us to actually not hide from it. And so many ways, I take that's an opportunity for us as adults, for those of us in many different systems, to say, you know what, this has always been here. How could we actually take this challenge head on and ensure that we are not here in 2022 still talking about the same racial disparities, the same economic disparities, and we need to deal with them at many, many levels?
So do you have any examples of some situations, personal or not, that you know of and that definitely you included in your research?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the, I think, big example that I have witnessed it, and I have young kids, and so, you know, so one of it is, I won't say the name of the program, but I think they'll be treated as one of the most highly touted, high quality programs in the country. And this was actually, we were actually watching it through a monitor. So we were actually sitting outside the room and we can actually watch it. Like most, a lot of our large programs have ways you can actually watch a classroom. And I remember this one is always going to be in my mind for probably as long as I live. And I remember one where there was sort of a group of who looked non-white, let's just say non-white boys, but they looked phenotypically Black. And I remember the boys were building this sort of like really complex train sort of tracks and things with blocks. And what I remember clearly was a teacher just walking over. Like they looked up thinking the teacher was going to come and commend them or talk to them about their whole complex structure they spent literally clearly all morning, at least during that time building. The child looked up and then the teacher walked over this, like literally walked over like it didn't exist to go get another child to just talk with. And that may not seem as biased, but we witness those kind of things happening where the only time that boy actually got attention was say, go sit down, go do something. It was this sort of harshness in the voice of this teacher. Mind you, this boy has been sitting there really working hard. And I think looking for that affirmation that, oh my God, let's talk about your work. And think about what it does to the soul of a child when somebody who they think is sort of like, oh my God, this is my teacher. She's there for me. And when they feel like this teacher doesn't care for me, doesn't even want to talk to me and only wants to treat me in sort of this unfair publicly shame and weigh. So to me, a lot of times it's all these things that are happening in the classroom that I think destroys the spirit and the soul of a child. I think it's the one thing we should really, really think about.
This makes me sort of think of some research that I definitely heard about a long time ago. Public school teachers show favoritism to students that look like them. And what we know now about many, many, many public schools across the country is that most of the children are children of color and most of the teachers are not. So to me, that's problematic.
Yeah, I mean, this is... One, you know, we can't change the workforce, right? It's 80% mostly white females compared to the majority minority students that we have. But I do think there are things that we can do. And I should first remind us too that, you know, there's, you know, not all teachers of color are also great for children of color, right? Like I think at the end of it, we need great teachers writ large. But nevertheless, though, I think having a teacher who looks like you, you know, takes a little bit of the pressure off of the child when they know, okay, this classroom and environment fits with the way I talk, the way I think, you know, my family and my parents maybe can connect with them better. There is a little bit more opportunity for strengthen the classroom environment because of that alignment with race, between the race of the teacher and the child. But I think what we have to do is in many ways that we have to ensure that our higher ed programs are really ensuring that they are training teachers for the real world, right? Not training teachers for the children that they think that they want, but the children that they have. So that means that a lot of our higher ed needs to be much more sophisticated around anti-racist, anti-bias teaching. They have to be really attuned to what is culture responsive practices. They have to really be thinking about teaching as a social justice kind of approach, not just I'm a good teacher, so every child will learn under me, but that it's actually an act of social justice that you're teaching. And for children of color, they have a different kind of life that needs to be part of the teaching instruction and teaching environment and curricula. And so we need to do a much better job of articulating that. I think what we've been doing a lot of times is sort of saying you're a good teacher, colorblind teaching, like that has helped us. No. So I do think we need to be much more forceful and much more intentional to speak to this issue of we have a mismatch and we need to do better at that particular thing.
Ioma Iruka is the director of the Early Childhood Health and Racial Equity Program at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also the co-author of the book, Don't Look Away, Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. More in a moment.
Hey, I'm Russ Henry. I work with Leonita here at WUNC. Hope you're enjoying this episode. I'll let you get back to it, but I need just a minute to tell you about some other shows from WUNC you may like. Our politics podcast is basically required listening as we get closer and closer to the huge election day in our state. Capitol reporter Jeff Tabiri is all over the issues, the elected officials, and the news that's driving debate and policy in North Carolina. And speaking of news, the State of Things podcast features conversations with newsmakers, journalists, artists, activists, and others who are influencing the culture of North Carolina every single day. Hosts Frank Stacio and Anita Rao offer a kind of up-close look at our state you won't get anywhere else. Check out the WUNC Politics podcast and the State of Things podcast right here on this app you're listening to. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of these shows.
Early voting has started in North Carolina, and whether you're voting in person or casting your ballot by mail, it's important to make sure your vote counts. This election has seen a surge in absentee ballots due to the pandemic, but barriers still exist for having the ballots counted. Earlier this week, the North Carolina State Board of Elections said a disproportionate number of Black voters' absentee ballots were, quote, pending cure, meaning they were missing some required information to be counted. Unfortunately, this isn't the first election this has happened.
We were curious to see if there was any patterns in the demographics of the voters who were being rejected. And unfortunately, we found that minority voters, especially Black voters, were much more likely than white voters to have their ballots rejected.
Sophie Chow is a data reporter with the investigative news outlet ProPublica.
She recently teamed up with another data reporter at WRAL to analyze absentee ballots in North Carolina from the 2018 midterm election. They found that Black voters were more than twice as likely to have ballots rejected than white voters. Chow says this is a big problem because if someone's mail-in ballot isn't counted, chances are good folks won't try to vote a second time.
From our analysis, we found that 85% of people who had their first mail-in ballot rejected didn't end up voting in any way, so they just didn't cast a vote in the election. About 1 in 10 Black voters who voted by mail, like, they ultimately didn't have their vote counted by any other method. So, like, they didn't end up voting a day of election or anything. And that was, like, more than twice the rate for white voters.
Chow says there's no clear evidence of Black voters' ballots intentionally being rejected, mostly because racial information isn't evident to people counting the ballots. Nevertheless, she says it's important for folks to know what's required to make sure their mail-in ballot is counted.
We don't want to add more, skepticism towards voting. I think that there are lots of potential rooms for bias or error in voting by mail, but the takeaway wasn't that voting by mail is a bad thing. It's just that a lot of scrutiny has to be placed and a lot of education has to be done so people can do it properly.
The requirements for casting an absentee ballot in North Carolina have been stuck in court for weeks, causing confusion for voters and those counting the ballots. A federal judge ruled this week that absentee ballots will require a witness signature, but that voters will have the chance to fix other minor issues without casting a new ballot. Meanwhile, early voting in person will last until the end of October. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Leonida Inge. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.